The case is unusual in that the defendants are charged with crimes committed in the name of the law. These men, together with their deceased or fugitive colleagues, are the embodiment of what passed for justice. They sat in their black robes and they distorted, they perverted, they destroyed justice and law. They distorted, they perverted, they destroyed justice and law. Now this in itself is undoubtedly a great crime.
Okay, here we are for episode 53 of Old School Guns on December 19th, the day after the infamous impeachment vote. Now everybody kind of knows this is BS, that it's grandstanding, that they want to be able to say, you know, it's about getting even for Bill Clinton being impeached for all of his sexual assaults and, you know, the whatever he was doing, when we all know what that was, with the intern Monica Lewinsky. It's about getting even for all that. They just didn't feel that sex crimes done by President Clinton were impeachable. And they felt that way. And they felt it was unfair that he was impeached. I think almost all the rest of the country kind of thought that, yeah, there definitely needed to be something there. Now, whether or not you believe that that's a high crime and misdemeanor, which, you know, I believe it is, but other people don't, you know, that is what it is. And this is simply trying to get even for that. They're taking a president that's very popular with his base, because unlike any other president that I have ever seen in my lifetime, Donald Trump tries to uphold his promises. He made campaign promises, and he's tried to uphold every one. You may not like the promises he made. A lot of people don't like the idea of a border wall and that we have an orderly immigration process. A lot of people don't like that. But I think that a lot of people do. And so, you can just go down the list of things that he's tried to do. What he's done in trade has been miraculous. He has undone terrible trade deals. And, you know, he's saved billions and billions of dollars and probably millions of jobs. So, you know, he's done what he has promised to do, what the voters endorsed him to do and gave him a mandate to do. And, you know, there are Democrats that don't like that. I don't understand why, but there are Democrats who want to see the country choked down under regulation, environmental laws, all kinds of things that restrict business and make it impossible for people to get a decent return on their investment. And the fact of the matter is, when you put all these social laws, environmental laws, high taxation, all these things together, it stifles the economy. And that hurts the people at the bottom the worst, because they need jobs. They need businesses to be prosperous to create jobs. And when that's all restricted, that's why our country took, you know, 10 years to get over the last recession. The Obama policies were trash. They were designed to punish people in business, not encourage them, so that the wealth permeates through society and gets to where, you know, everybody kind of wants to see it go, and that is that people can get decent jobs depending on their skill and education and every other level. People can get decent jobs, and people then can then become, you know, generate the kind of income that they need and become upwardly mobile. They can actually get additional education, get additional advantages, and do that. They don't want to see that. They want to see everything as a government-controlled giveaway program, so that a capitalist like Trump, not only do they hate his ideas, but they hate who he is, what he is, where he came from, and what he's achieved in his life. They hate all that. And so, you know, that's a big part of all this. The Democrats are criminals. I mean, the Judiciary Committee and Intelligence Committee, whatever other, you know, garbage committee they ran this thing through, Nadler and Schiff are criminals. And we have a little bit of a montage here from one of my favorite movies, Judgment at Nuremberg, which, you know, basically they had to try government criminals too. And what they said about the Nazi war criminals in the judiciary is the same for what the politicians have done, the Democratic Party politicians.
The case is unusual in that the defendants are charged with crimes committed in the name of the law. These men, together with their deceased or fugitive colleagues, are the embodiment of what passed for justice. They sat in their black robes and they distorted, they perverted, they destroyed justice and law. They distorted, they perverted, they destroyed justice and law. Now this in itself is undoubtedly a great crime.
And yet, this is what the Democrats have done. They have done everything that was in that clip I just played for you. They have perverted, distorted, and absolutely ruined the notion of justice. And they've used their position to do that. So remember that voting day. There are, I realize Pelosi and Schiff and probably some of the rest will get reelected because they're in safe districts where the robots will vote for them no matter what. But the fact of the matter is, in a swing district, you have to run these people out. If you've got a Democratic representative, you have to vote against them on every level. Every Democratic politician is guilty of these crimes. Guilty by association, guilty because they support the apparatus which has brought this around. So you have to punish the apparatus, and you do that by punishing every Democrat that's on a ballot. And you punish them by voting for someone else. I'm not saying you have to convert into a Republican if you don't like the Republican Party, but you don't have to vote for the Democrat. Just don't vote for them. Just either leave your ballot blank or vote for an independent or a libertarian or whatever it is you want to do. But do not hand the House of Representatives back to this scum, this cabal of scum, this axis of evil. Don't do it. And if you have a Democratic senator, the same thing. Even nice old Joe Manchin in West Virginia, who's always kind of pretending he's sort of like ideologically is a Republican, but he's a Democrat. No, kick the guy out. Kick the guy out. And if these people aren't up, some of these people at local and state levels may not be up for re-election because 2020 is a big year, presidential election year, but sometimes these people get in off-year elections or whatever. So that's when you do the recall process. Do the recall process and see if you can recall a couple people. That will send some shockwaves through the Democratic Party. That and a major electoral defeat in 2020 will send shockwaves through them. So, you know, no one is going to win this election. You're going to have to fight to win because the Democrats aren't going to just come out and lose it. You have to fight them to win it. And that's what everyone has to do on local, state, and national levels. They have created an absolute mess in our government, and they need to be punished for it. And the best way to punish a politician is to vote them out. Vote their sorry asses out. They are absolutely the most corrupt, the most ideologically, illogically driven people. They really can't be trusted. So, you know, and I'm not saying the Republican Party is perfect, but I am saying that right now, the people who have got the most manure on their hands are the Democrats. And the Democrats need to be nationally, locally, and statewide punished. Punish them as much as you can. Okay, now that we've covered the crime of the day, crime of the year, and maybe even the crime of all time, let's talk about some gun-related stuff. Oh, a couple of interesting videos hit YouTube and Patreon and Full 30 this week. And let's see. Forgotten Weapons did a shoot of the Chauché, You know, the guy, Gun Jesus, Ian McCollum, for the most part, does what he does pretty well, I think. He took a Chowche and was kind of doing some field firing with it. And of course, the weapon to me is very unimpressive for what it is. His thought behind this test was, well, it's really a select fire weapon, which it is, and it really is at its best when it's used as a semi-automatic kind of bipod supported rifle, as opposed to a fully automatic squad automatic weapon. And there's he did a test where he essentially bore that out. He was able to get more hits on a couple of silhouette targets, half silhouettes, at 100 yards, I believe, than he would have than he did when he was firing fully automatic. And I think that is what it is. Part of fully automatic fire is suppression. So when you're doing suppressive fire, you're not necessarily going to get a high hit count, but you're causing the enemy to act differently because of your fire, and hope those actions are advantageous to your elements that are maneuvering to try to, get into the trench or breach an obstacle or do something else. So, there's kind of two schools of thought. The thing that always surprises me about the Chowche is, I realize it was kind of a first effort, and it's not fair to judge it by subsequent weapons, but I will have to say that it's a dismal weapon. It was a dismal weapon. It was a very inferior weapon to have. Going to the reliability, the ergonomics, just there's not anything really likable there, other than history. Other than history, there's nothing likable about it. Absolutely nothing. So kind of there you go. And the weapon that InRange TV, CNR Arsenal, Forgotten Weapons never like, the BAR, is a phenomenal weapon. It's a phenomenal weapon. And in many cases you could argue that as a automatic rifle, using it in the semi-automatic mode, it was probably more effective. You would get a lot more hits than you would be using it in the select fire mode, fully automatic. But the BAR is a lot more dependable, a lot more reliable. The sighting system's a lot better. The ergonomics are better. The whole thing is just better. And one of the complaints that has surfaced on all those channels is, well, the World War I version didn't really have a bipod, but they don't like the World War II version that had a bipod. But the bottom line is you can use a lot of positions, and there's a lot of terrain and things. When you're actually out maneuvering, there's a lot of things that kind of mitigate the use of a bipod or don't make it all that necessary. When you're shooting on a square range or a range type scenario, flat range, you don't have undulations in the terrain. You don't have logs to support the thing on. You don't have trees. You don't have a lot of the things, broken down walls in a city or wrecked cars, or whatever it is you're using for cover and for a firing position. And I know this from just training with a semi-automatic RPK. It's like it's got a fold-out bipod. It really doesn't get used that much because, frankly, if you're doing positional shooting, you're doing opportunistic shooting, shooting targets of opportunity. You're going to just take up, you're always going to be in non-standard, unorthodox positions doing something. And a lot of times the bipod does not really help you in that. So, the bipod is, it is what it is. They're nice to have, but they don't get as much use as everybody thinks. We're all used to the training films of people at Fort Benning and everything else. And they go out and plop down on the ground and they got the bipod out there. But, in real combat, especially in the ETO, I don't really know about the Pacific that much, but in the ETO, or European Theater of Operations, really, there was a lot of fighting done in built-up rubble and areas that had a lot of terrain and a lot of relief on the terrain, a lot of trees and stuff like that. So I'm not really sure that the BIPOC was absolutely essential. And that was especially true in World War I, where getting the weapons there was really the overriding thing. It's better to have 2,000 BARs in your front lines at the end of the Argonne Offensive than it is to have them sitting in a factory having bipods put on them, or still en route because extra time was taken to design and figure out a bipod. It just, they had to get the weapons to the front as soon as they could. And even if it was somewhat imperfect by not having a bipod, the overall good was that lives would be saved by having these much, much better weapons in the hands of the frontline troops. But the Chauche lovers and all this don't really kind of want to get... They seem to want to do the revisionist history of saying, well, it's not really as bad as people say. There's a couple of channels for military history trying to do the same thing with the Sherman tank. Really wasn't as bad as people say. It didn't really deserve the reputation for being, you know, thin-walled, undergunned. And, you know, frankly, I think the reputation it has is the reputation it has. The people who used it gave it the reputation. The people who used the Chauche gave it the reputation. And so, you know, it is what it is. Trying to rewrite history, I just don't think is, I don't think we're capable of it. We're not in the conditions. We don't have the same tasks. And really, the guns that we have that survived from that time are now 100 years old. So if the Chauche that is on Forgotten Weapons jams, I don't really think twice about that, because I just say, well, it's 100 years old. Its magazines are 100 years old. All the springs and all that has got wear. And, you know, I don't look that the ones we have today are necessarily exactly as they were. There's a 100-year difference there, 100 years. But... you know, we do have the contemporary reports that really point out how unsatisfactory the Chauche was. Okay, next piece of news, and this has kind of been out there for a while, but it's pretty exciting in some ways. And I don't know, I don't really know what I think about it. SIG has reintroduced a U.S.-made version of their famous 210 pistol, the SIG P210. And this was like the first 9mm pistol that was made by SIG, I think, after the Second World War. It was adopted by, you know, a few countries, you know, I don't know the extent. But they were always very expensive because they were quite well made. And, you know, single stack, 9mm, single action, very accurate, was a good pistol. I saw one in Iraq, but I can't remember who had it. It might have been a Danish army officer. I'm just guessing then, because I remember looking, saying, hey, you have a SIG P210. I saw him in a mess hall, and it just stood out to me. And he said, yes, I have a SIG Neuhausen, which I think the factory was in Neuhausen, and some of the Europeans would call it a SIG Neuhausen. And, you know, I remember just making some small talk and then kind of moving on and thinking that's pretty unusual to see a pistol that age. You know, you would see, I saw a Browning High Power, and, you know, you would see a few things kind of like that being carried, but not mostly. You know, most countries have just gone to off-the-shelf Glock. You know, Britain has now gone to off-the-shelf Glock, because that's just... it's just so cost-effective, gives them a reliable weapon, cost-effective, and so they go there. But an American-made P210, and I kind of looked these things up. You know, the European ones, you know, I priced them a few years ago. There were actually some surplus ones that were released on the market, what was it, about 15 years ago. And I think those were selling for like $2,000. I'm sorry, it was about $1,400 to $2,000, depending on condition. You know, I know those are the real deal, but they are used. These are brand new. I assume that they're made on a on CNC machining and all the rest of it. So whether or not it's got 100% parts interchangeability, I couldn't tell you. I would hope so. These sell for around $1,000. So, You can get into one. If you always admired it and wanted one, this is an excellent opportunity to do that. It won't have the history behind it of being an actual SIG and Neuhausen-made pistol, but it's the same thing put out by the company, and it's probably eminently functional, probably more accurate due to the CNC machining tolerances and all that than the original pistols were. But the original pistols really garnered a reputation as a target gun, which I always found a little bit curious. I fired one when I was stationed in Germany. It belonged to as a member of a shooting group, and it had predominantly Germans, but a few Americans in it. One of the Germans owned one, and it was a nice gun. I just remember being, I hate to say underwhelmed, but when you're used to things like gold cups and some, target automatics, the Sig Neuhausen was good, the P210 was good, but it really didn't stimulate me to buy one. I mean, it really didn't enthrall me that much. The other thing I always found with 9mm pistols that were meant to be kind of target pistols is the fact that there's really no 9mm match ammunition. At that time, there was, if you're shooting bullseye, you want match ammunition. And nowadays, the standards on targets are a lot different. The type of shooting is different. So 9mm ball ammunition is perfectly fine for most gun games. But for when you're doing actual bullseye, precision shooting, scoring rings, X rings, match ammunition can make a difference. And there's not really any match bullets. There's no 9mm match kind of following or infrastructure the way there is, or used to be anyway, for 45 ACP. Where the 200 grain H&G wad cutter, and I've loaded more than a few of those myself. And those were excellent loads. The 20, the softball target load, and so there you go. It's tougher to do the match thing with 9mm, but with most of the shooting nowadays, it really isn't necessary, so it doesn't matter. But yeah, the 210 is interesting. It would be fun. They still at $1,000 though. You can, for half the price, you can get something very, very nice in 9mm. It's going to be a plasti gun and all the rest of it, but it's there. So that's just kind of the skinny on that. I think it'll be interesting to see how long they keep it in production, if they have enough sales to really justify keeping it going. It's kind of a classic. I'm glad to see it back, and I hope it sticks around. But for $1,000, that's a lot of moolah for a single stack 9mm that really has the use it's really the best at is kind of an obsolete use now, So we'll see how that shakes. Okay, Recoil Magazine. They've almost stole an idea from me, but they screwed it up like they usually do, I suppose. So it was fine. This goes back to the What Would Stoner Do 2020 or 2021 project that InRange TV is going to do. I spoke about it in a previous cast. I think it was 2017. They did What Would Stoner Do? And that was a how to make the lightest weight AR-15 you could. Essentially, that's what it was. And so they went through a whole bunch of things, and now they've got this boutique a company, KE Arms, is going to start selling the polymer lower again. And I guess they're even going to market them through Brownells. At least that's what they announced. Personally, I wish Brownells would just bring out a retro AR-180. Please bring out an AR-180 retro. But they're going to have do this What Would Stoner Do thing, and I think they're going to offer it as components and as assembled rifles or something. That's what their announcement was sort of there. Well, I thought, they've already done that, and the only thing that's going to change are maybe a few components, whatever. I think they should do, and Recoil almost did this, they should go to a What Would Jack Benny Do 2021, and that is, What is the least expensive AR build you can do? Now, Recoil Magazine sabotaged the whole thing because they went to Wish and got literally the cheapest things they could get. And the springs in their lower kit weren't to spec and all the rest of it. And so then they turn out a rifle that they kind of laugh at. They put a handguard on it where the rail is way out of spec and all the rest of this, you know. And I kind of looked at it and I went, you know, they kind of were making a joke gun out of it. They didn't even want to spend $2 on an ejection port cover. I think, but they started with some good components, you know. Anderson Lowers, hey, they're inexpensive, but man, they build decent ARs. I realize that the top end aficionados would cringe at something like that, but the fact of the matter is you can build an AR which is very, very good and rivals guns that are much more expensive. But anyway, they took all the cheap parts they could get and got blem parts and everything else, and they put this thing together for about $250, and then they put I think it was a Vortex or something red dot on it that actually cost more than the rest of the gun. So their complete build sheet with the optic was, I think, $700, $719, I guess, which was really foolish because they built a gun that they knew was not going to work very well. I think you could take the key to doing something like that is turning out a gun that is very, very functional, not one that's dysfunctional. So, you know, by starting with the heart of the Anderson lower and, you know, getting a decent lower parts kit with decent springs and, you know, buying the rest of the components from, you know, reputable but discount sources, put it together. And I don't think it needs an optic. You could just put a carry handle, you know, the detachable carry handle, because I think sighting systems are very individualistic, and someone may want to put a very inexpensive red dot on it and say, hey, I'm good, or they may want to do something else. I can't imagine they would completely cheap out on the rifle and then put an optic that costs more than their build would on it. I just don't see that as happening, but, you know, it's possible. But I would like to see a What Would Jack Benny Do build of an AR-15 using, you know, discount sourced parts, what the actual cost would be, and how then test the rifle and see how good it really is. And I bet you will find that it's a very good rifle. Now, the question will always come to mind is it worth doing that as opposed to buying a Ruger 5.56 AR or Smith & Wesson M&P or one of the deep, or, you know, a bottom-end DPMS offering? Is it worth building it as opposed to buying it off the shelf and getting a guarantee of some kind, getting some kind of a warranty with it? I would tend to be a little more conservative and go with the warranty part, but... you know, if you've got to save every dollar, you know, even if it's just a curiosity project of how inexpensively can I build a quality AR, it'd be interesting to take that and then weigh it against the What Would Stoner Do gun to see, well, how much of a weight difference is there, and is the weight difference really worth the additional cost? Because the last build sheet, the build sheet I saw on their 2017 What Would Stoner Do deal was like $1,700 total. I mean, I don't care. I'm a big boy. I will carry an extra 2 pounds on my AR, you know, before I spend three times the money or whatever it is, or twice the money to buy these other components. The other thing that's I'm suspicious of, lightweight components, there is no free lunch, so you always know that there's going to be a trade-off in durability, at least durability, maybe reliability too, but there's always going to be a trade-off with durability. So is having a 6-pound AR really a better deal than a 7.5-pound AR? You know, is it really going to be worth that much and risking that much in durability and reliability to get that weight savings? So I would say that it is probably not worth that, but that's in the eye of the customer. Okay, the next gun culture comment we got is, again, going back to Forgotten Weapons, they did a great and very interesting video on the steel that was used in the Ballister Molina pistol. And, you know, it really kind of goes back to some urban gun legends that were put out there that the Ballister Molina was made from the armored steel of the World War II German battle cruiser Graf Spee, which was, you know, scuttled in the estuary in between Buenos Aires and Montevideo. I think it's the Platte River, or Plata maybe in Spanish, I don't know. But anyway, it was scuttled there. And it was kind of out in the middle, but the water there isn't very deep, so consequently, the superstructure and a lot of the ship was above water. You know, eventually the British got some sort of salvage rights to it, purely for espionage purposes to go look at the fire control systems and gun direction systems on it that were still that probably had survived the scuttling, or at least pieces of those systems, so they could kind of figure out if the German gunnery was how superior, if at all, it really was, and what systems they were using. So anyway, and from there was the linkage was made that the fact that the British wanted some deniable pistols for use in clandestine operations, so they wanted Ballister Molina pistols, which were completely deniable to the British. So if somebody gets caught with one, it's not like they got a Webley and, you know, an umbrella and, you know, a coat that was made in Piccadilly Circus. You know, they basically have a very deniable weapon, and the person himself could not be linked to the British government as any kind of an agent. So anyway, the connection was made that, well, if the British had salvage rights to this, the steel from this ship could have been used to make the Ballister Molina pistols, because Argentina did not have sufficient quantities of steel that they could could allocate to that project. So on, and this was, I first heard it, I think it was radio personality and former Watergate burglar G. Gordon Liddy on his radio show. He had a Ballister Molina. He said, hey, this is indeed the case. It's made by some of the finest steel that was ever on the planet, you know, the German armored steel, on and on and on. And some people believe it, some people don't. 4 or 5 years ago, there was an article in the American Rifleman where the steel of a Ballister Molina pistol was tested against some German armored plate that was taken from a tank, and they were found to be very, very different. So and I don't remember all the specifics of the article, but I think what it really came down to was the Ballister Molina was made by a decent grade of steel that you would expect in gun manufacture. And in fact, it was very different from the armored plate on the that had been taken from a tank. Well, I would say that I don't know that battleship armor and tank armor are the same, or even close. But I do know that armor plate of any kind and regular ordnance steel are very different enough so that you would not confuse them. You would not forget to put armor plate on and put ordnance steel on in its place. You just wouldn't do that. So the other argument is, well, there's all kinds of steel on a naval warship. You know, it's not all armor plate. There's regular steel that's used for all sorts of things, and this steel could have been harvested and used. You know, part of that is, well, I don't know that you would all have the same kind. I don't know that it would be worth doing that. You really only need about 3 truckloads of steel to make the 7,000 pistols that the British wanted. I'm assuming that's probably 3 truckloads of steel. When you look at a Ballester Molina, kind of say, well, it takes this much steel, and you know, multiply that by 7,000, and then look at a truck. I think the trucks at the time, you know, a 5 or 10 ton truck, probably 3 truckloads, I would think. You know, and you know, would you want to really have a mixture of different salvaged steels? I would say from two perspectives, you would not. One is, well, it's going to be harder on your machine tools. If you get very, very hard steel, it's going to be tough on your machine tools. So that you're going to lose a lot of economy there. And the other side is, if you get inappropriate steel for making guns, a little bit weaker, or it doesn't have the properties you want, you could wind up with a large batch of guns that don't meet, you know, the performance that's expected of them. So my sense is that they sourced steel somewhere, and they built the guns for the British. And, you know, the salvage steel, who knows? But it still could be. It still could be, because you don't need that much steel. So maybe somebody got enough off the wreck to essentially do that. But you never know. We'll never actually know unless somebody discovers some, you know, heretofore unknown documentation that's proven to be authentic, that says, yes, we did go out there and cut 3 or 4 big pieces off the superstructure, and we used that to build the pistols. So anyway, until that kind of thing comes up, it's still a legend, has not been disproven, but probably a little bit more less credible than before. But it was interesting, and I enjoyed the video, because that had been put out. Like I said, G. Gordon Liddy put that out in one of his books, and even on his radio show. And it's always cropped up from now and then. It would be very cool if it was true. I think it's one of those things that it's such a good story that everybody kind of hopes it'll be true. But in fact, it's probably not. But there's still a little ray of hope out there for some of the people who want to believe that. Okay, here we are at the question and answers. Question and answers. So, got a couple ones. Oh, what actually related to the last question and answer. So this ought to be interesting. And this one I modified a little bit to be a little broader. In light of your previous comments about USPSA shooting, is there any training benefit in USPSA or 3-gun or other competitions which use the PCC, and that is pistol caliber carbine? Are there any benefits? And you know, that's a very good question, because I actually think that fast handling of a carbine is a good thing. And it minimizes the amount of game-specific equipment you have. You can shoot it with iron sights. You can shoot it with the optic of your choice. Most people who have a pistol caliber carbine equip them with some kind of an optic, because it's essentially a pretty close range weapon, and they want to be very, very fast with it. So, you know, actually, as I kind of reviewed that and thought about it, I think there actually is some good benefits. Now, it's not in the stages or realistic or anything like that. It's quick. It's really in the mechanical manipulation of a carbine quickly under time stress. So I would say that, you know, if you are saddled with one of those for whatever reason, and you basically want to learn how to handle it faster under pressure and do those things, that's not a bad competition to get into. It would definitely have some relevance. I think most of those stages start with it. It basically, the carbine, and, you know, you're kind of holding it against your belt type of deal with the muzzle pointed downrange. So, you know, that's not completely unrealistic position that you would have a carbine in. So it's pretty good. I would say yes. What do I think about pistol carbines? Well, They are enjoying a renaissance, which is fun, which is nice. The thing that killed them was the same thing that killed like the MP5 and special operations use and everything else, is that you can get a very lightweight, I mean, and I'm not talking about what would Stoner do, I'm talking about your M4 is very lightweight, competitive weight to one of these pistol caliber carbines, and much more effective, has much more range, much more power, and takes common, you know, AR magazines. It's got all the advantages that everybody has talked about forever. And that basically, and 5.56 ammo is inexpensive enough. It's competitive with 9mm ammo. So, you know, why would you use a 9mm? Why would you do that? And I guess there are reasons. The original Ruger police carbine, you know, PC6, you know, or PC9 and PC40. PC9 and PC40. You know, those were actually designed that if you're, and I mean, you would have had to work for a pretty budget-minded department, I'll say that. If you had a P-series handgun, Ruger handgun, you would have a carbine that took the same ammunition and the same magazines. My criticism of that thinking has always been that you usually wind up with an underpowered carbine. And while it's probably fine for most uses, I think that the comfort zone of having a 5.56, it just, you know, overshadowed it, and that's why the concept never took off. My belief is if you have a handgun and a carbine that take the same ammo, you either have a too powerful of a handgun or an underpowered carbine. Or you could get a rare situation where you have both, where maybe your 10mm pistol is too uncomfortable to shoot, and your 10mm carbine is not as efficient as a it's a 5.56. So there you go. You know, you could have the worst of both worlds, I suppose. But, you know, they're out there. It's fun. I think it'll be there for a while. I really never studied the impetus as to why those have come back in to vogue, why they're having a renaissance. It's be interesting. That's something I'll check out. But anyway, yes, you know, that is a good way to get used to handling them quickly. Okay. Now, we're back to the 1911. What about the 1911 don't you like? And that's a good question. I'm a 1911 man. I grew up with them, basically, so I like them. I still think that, you know, in the cold light of dawn, it's a nice gun to have at your side or in your hand. Or if it's, you know, cold and dark and you're in a foxhole, that's the gun you want to have if there's a bad person who's trying to get in there and do you harm. So, you know, I believe in the 1911, and I like it. A couple things I don't like about it. Let's see. First of all, I don't like the plunger tube, spring and plunger that, you know, give the tension to the safety. I don't think that was a great design. They're kind of staked on there. Now, that being said, I've never really had a problem with one. But I, you know, it is probably a little less efficient than it could have been. But it's also 100 years old, so, you know, you give it that benefit of the doubt. And since it doesn't give, really, it's never given me any problems, I don't see where it's that big a problem. But yeah, I admit that design is probably not optimal. The other thing I don't like are the kind of sights on the earliest guns. You know, the 1943, I consider the minimum good 1911 sight to be the 1943 GI style, where you have the serrated front blade and you have the kind of the little bit larger rear sight. Those were good sights. Those are actually, you know, they're not great, but they're good. For then, they were really good, probably. You know, for 1943, they were probably really good. Nowadays, they're kind of minimum, but they're still usable, still workable. So, yeah, I like those sights. The earlier type sights that were on the earlier 1911 A1s and the 1911s, My current eyesight does not support those. Does not support using those. I find them very difficult to see and use. And that's because my eyesight is less than perfect and getting more imperfect every day. So I don't like those. Now, I will say that it was 2 years ago now, I had a 1911 built just kind of on a whim. And I used a fusion frame and I used some Colt parts I had and put together a really nice gun. And it's got big sights on it, which I really like. And use those. And it's like trying to drive a 5-ton truck with no power steering to going to, a very modern car which has excellent power steering. So it really makes a huge difference to have nice, big, easy to see and adjustable sights on it. So I would say the sights and the safety plunger tube dealie. Those are the two things I don't like. Everything else I'm pretty much good with. I've never really tried to shoot it with cold weather gloves that much. I've used regular gloves, but not really, big bulky gloves. So I'm looking at the trigger guard isn't, like most pistols, is not optimized for that. Some of the more modern pistols I see are have larger trigger guards, I'm assuming to accommodate gloves and other things. So that's probably another, point you could always bring up, but it doesn't really affect me, so I don't really recognize it as a limitation. So anyway, that's the best I can do for that question. Okay, what is the best deal on a 1911 type pistol in the market today? And I couldn't tell you what the best deal is. I can tell you though that Classic Firearms is selling the Turkish 1911 A1, and I mean it looks like a GI. The pictures look, it looks completely GI to me. Completely GI 1911 A1. They're selling that for like $339 today anyway. If I did not have one, I'd be seriously tempted to jump on one of those. Jump on one of those because, even though Turkey's not exactly the kind of government that I'd really dig very much for a variety of reasons, looks like a pretty good deal to me for a 1911. You certainly can't argue with the money. I mean, that's a lot less expensive. The only thing that you can get really cheaper on the market is there's some real crappy quality Wonder Nines out there that were selling for less than that. The Walther Creed, whatever that was, is something they don't even make anymore, and they're just dumping the rest. They were dogs, and they were dumping them. But this 1911 looks pretty good, and I'd be seriously tempted to go with it. Now, what I don't know is what are the nuances of it. Does it have the 1943 style sights? There's no guarantee that it does, although my assumption, my hope would be that it did. But Arms Corps in the Philippines makes a very good 1911. Auto Ordnance makes a very nice 1911. There are a lot of good basic 1911 A1s out there that are good pistols. So I would probably though, if I were really in a money crunch, I would probably go with the Turkish one that Classic Firearms is selling. And I mean, face it, it's twice the price of a High Point, but you're getting five times the gun. So there you go. Okay, our next question is, why is a high-end custom 1911 a waste of time and money? Now, in light of all those nice things I've been saying about 1911 design and all that, why would I think that? Because I have stated that in the past. And by high-end, I mean these very, very custom pistols that are $4,000 and $5,000, Well, here's how I see them. If you're shooting target competition with a 1911 and you have a gunsmith build you one from the bottom up, and you want the, and I'm just going to throw names out there. What is it? Wilson, Bear, Nighthawk Custom, all these guys. You want their best target pistol with adjustable sights and all that. Hey, you know, go for it. That's just what that is. That's like buying a high-end set of golf clubs. It's for that. The pistols, though, that are, they're kind of advertised for defensive use. You know, those are the ones I kind of look at a little bit and go, because frankly, I would never use a gun that high-end as a defensive gun. I mean, it would be fun to own, and they're fun to shoot, and they're great objects of pride, and probably, you know, and they're very excellently made. There's nothing wrong with the craftsmanship or workmanship. It's just the intended purpose. If I actually used one in a defensive shooting, I could say, well, you know, I spent the best, and I got the performance out of it, and, you know, it saved my life, so it's fulfilled its role. But the fact of the matter is, that gun is going to be probably confiscated by the police, probably not treated the way you would treat it, as a $4,000 or $5,000 item. It would be, you know, it's, and whether or not you get it back or in what condition and all the rest, that's it. Or if you, it's a gun you carry around and, you know, heaven forbid you drop it, heaven forbid that, you know, something happens to it, they break into your Rolls Royce and steal it. Because if you are carrying a gun like that for defense, you probably do drive a Bentley or a Rolls Royce. But, you know, kidding around aside, you know, is that a gun that you risk in that kind of an endeavor? Or do you buy the police trade-in Glock, which is kind of scruffy, and just say, hey, whatever happens to this, happens to this? Or the $339 Turkish 1911 A1 clone, which, you know, once you prove that it functions, then maybe that's what you carry. And if that is wound up in the police evidence locker while they're clearing you of a shooting, well, then so be it, you know. So I think that market was always kind of an artificial market. If for target shooting, and I talked about, you know, the time I went to F. Bob Chow, who was a great pistol smith, who made target 1911s. So the market in those days was to turn the 1911 into a target gun. So, you know, if you want a target gun and you're willing to pay for it, or if it's a gun you say, I want the most accurate 1911 I can have, that's different than saying I'm going to carry one of these things. The thing that's always surprising about this is, you know, custom pistol smith guns, even engraved ones sometimes, you know, you just don't realize the money out of them that you would like. You know, people say, this is a Bill Wilson, da, 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 da. A lot of people aren't going to spend $3,000 for a used gun, or they're not, you know, that's just, if you have the kind of money to buy one, they usually buy a new one, which is going to be, have all the features that they want, and it's going to be made to their specifications, you know. And so, you know, used, the very expensive used Wilson, Nighthawk Custom, all the rest of these, you know, they're probably pretty tough sell on the secondary market. So if you buy one, you better like it, because turning it over, you probably might take a beating on that. So that's another reason I don't really like them. And I think they're a waste of money in that respect, is that they're not a good firearms investment. If you want to invest in a firearm, get out and learn, and then buy a desirable collector's piece, keep it in great shape, hold on to it for 10 years and then sell it, you know, when you retire or whatever, and you will have made money. A fancy custom 1911 from 10 years ago is not going to realize even its purchase price, I don't believe. I just don't believe. The kind of people who would be interested in it are kind of the guys who maybe want one, but know they're never really going to have the money for a new one, but they might be able to scrape up a third or half of the original purchase price, and then just hope that somebody sells them one on the secondary market because they just want to get out of it, and they want to get out of it whatever they can get out of it, you know. So that's what I believe. That's why I believe they're a waste of money Why are they a waste of time? Well, the effort that goes into it, it depends on its, again, its intended use. And I don't know. I just think there are a lot more cost-effective things. But there also is vanity. You know, why do people engrave guns that, you know, they, to carry around and to, I don't want to say show off, but it's a badge of affluence. You know, if you have one of these very high-end guns, they're a badge of affluence. There's no question about that. And some people want that. Why do people use Rolex watches? Well, it's a badge of affluence or a badge of discriminating taste. But you're going to pay for that when you go to sell these high-end guns. They're just, the buyers out there on the secondary market just are not, they're just not there. Well, this brings to an end another edition of Old School Guns. This is podcast 53, number 53. So anyway, if you like what you hear and want to hear more, definitely hit the follower button on whatever platform you are and follow us, and you'll get a notification of when our next episode posts. The other thing you can also do is leave us comments. You can always send us comments, leaving them on the Podbean site or that's probably the best place right there, because that always gives me a prompt that there's a new comment. My personal email gets spammed and advertisements hitting it so much that I could easily miss a comment. So it's better to put it on the platform of the site. So anyway, I don't know if we'll do another cast before the holidays, Christmas and New Year's. So if I can, I will. But if I do not, please have a very, very happy holiday season, a Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy New Year, whatever applies. Take it very little. Doesn't matter. But have a great holiday season. And this is Old School Guns out.